up on your
behalf. How are we going to restore 15 to 20 million jobs? I am your future.
Isn't it about time for a change?
We're our national leaders.
AmericanWorkersRadio.com.
You're listening to American Workers Radio, a national network promoting American-made products with your host, Michael Blihash.
Well, welcome once again to another edition of American Workers Radio, broadcasting here on 860 AM Radio. And that serves with the radio signal, the southeastern Pennsylvania and the tri-state area. However, you can tune in from anywhere in the USA simply by logging on to AmericanWorkersRadio.com and click on the Listen Live link. And as you know, you can also hear rebroadcasts 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, simply by logging on to AmericanWorkersRadio.com and click on the Listen Anytime link. As always, I ask that you contact family members and friends and invite them to tune in now, or you'll text them the link to the radio broadcast later today. And thank you for all you're doing to help us maintain this great broadcast, which tries to unite the American people, especially America's consumers, to support everything possible made in the United States of America. I want to thank our panel members, Mark Andel, founder of the Made in America store, who's on a special, very special assignment today. He'll be with us again next week. Larkin Conley, national small business advocate. Bruce Bassett Powell, SCORE associate. Our engineer is Henry Chaplinsky, and I am Michael Blihash. First of all, thanks again for helping us spread the news. And as always, if you have some comments or suggestions, and we do have a special guest today, I'd like to get those suggestions so that I can ask the guests that come on and do, as I do other radio broadcasts, some people ask me a question. I am very happy to give them an answer. A lot of them are coming from you, the good listeners and people who support the Buy American Made campaign. Joining us today is a very well-respected guest on our broadcast, Professor Michael Bussler. Now, as you know, he's a noted guest on many American shows here in the USA talking about finance and things like that, and a very noted guest on American Workers Radio. And as you know, Professor Bussler is a professor at Stockton University in Galloway, New Jersey, where he teaches undergraduate and graduate courses in finance and economics with a demonstration history of working in the higher education history field. And that's an industry all of its own, because when you're speaking to a class, you have to let the class know what's happening in the world. And we're going to do that with the professor today. Professor, our supporters are very pleased to have you. First of all, say hello to everyone.
Well, hello, everybody. Thanks for having me. As you know, it's always my pleasure to be here.
And it's always a great pleasure to have you on the broadcast. People talk about how much they enjoy you, how they enjoy what you have to present, and they can understand why you make an outstanding teacher there at Stockton. You know, Professor, our supporters want to know what you would suggest if you were appointed the person to end the inflation we're experiencing in America right now. It's unbelievable. If you were the guy that was appointed and they said, Professor Michael Bussler is the guy who's going to handle this inflation issue, what would you like to start with?
So I think there are two things that the government can do right off the bat. One is, much of the inflation we've had really now almost the last 3 years, much of it has been caused by excess government spending. So in the last five fiscal years, 2021, 22, 23, and 24, last five fiscal years, the federal government has deficit spent, which means they spent more than they brought in tax revenue, $11 trillion in those five fiscal years. So, and that's all excess demand, and that all contributes significantly to inflation. So the first thing I would do is to try as hard as possible to get to as close to a balanced budget as possible. Now, it's very difficult, but we've got to stop spending more money than we are bringing in tax revenue. So that's the first thing I would do. Secondly, energy costs account for almost 30% of the consumer price index. Because not just are we buying heating oil and gas for our cars, but it's energy that companies have to buy to run their factories, to run their offices. So energy costs are a big part, say about 30% of the CPI. We can bring energy costs down simply by going back to the policies we had prior to the Biden administration. And those are policies that, through executive order, President Biden changed literally overnight. So a couple things involved there. One, you recall the Keystone Pipeline was ready to be built. It was probably about 11 months away from completion. He pulled the permit on that, so that couldn't be completed. That had that been completed by early 2021, we would have had another 900,000 barrels of oil flowing into the U.S. every day.
Every day.
That would have increased every day. Secondly, Biden withdrew the permits to drill on federal lands so that there's energy to be found there. Energy companies were ready to drill. He stopped that. Energy companies had to go other places, but there's a lot of oil there that's fairly easy to get out of the ground. And if he reversed that policy and allowed them to drill on federal lands like we did in the prior administration, that would increase the supply and bring oil prices down. Thirdly, President Biden made it the permitting process very difficult, time-consuming, and costly. He added all of these regulations that he believed were necessary, and in reality, I don't think they are, so reverse that process. So just starting there, that would increase the supply, that would increase the supply of energy, bring energy prices down to a reasonable level, and that would not only reduce inflation, it would actually bring prices down. So those are the two things that they can do immediately. The third thing, which is a little more difficult, because we had so much inflation, workers say, look, inflation's running, you know, 4%, 5%, 6%. I need a raise 4%, 5%, 6% just to keep up with inflation. That ends up driving labor costs up, and that pushes inflation up. Now, we can't do anything about that right away, but if we can have the government closer to balancing the budget, increase the supply of energy, that'll bring energy prices down, and that'll put some downward price pressure on wages. Now, people say, well, wait a minute, isn't it a good thing that people get higher wages? And it is. But if somebody wants a 5% wage increase, in theory, in the U.S. economy, a person is paid according to the value of their output. So if their productivity increases by 4 or 5%, then they certainly deserve a 4 or 5% raise. But what's happening now because of inflation, wages are going up in the 4 or 5% range. Productivity is only in the 2% range, and that's driving up prices. That's a little more difficult one to deal with, and we want to make sure that people get real increases in wages. That means that the wage increase is greater than the inflation rate. So prior to Biden coming into office, people were getting, you know, 2%, 2.5%, 3% raises, and inflation was only 1.5%. So that worked out very well for everybody. Now we have this wage inflation that we won't be able to do anything about until we bring the inflation rate down.
You know, Professor, you're absolutely right. And, you know, all of this with inflation has caused growing poverty throughout the United States of America. If a person was living in poverty, if a person had a part-time job and they were raising children or taking care of a parent or something, they are really being hurt very, very deeply. A gentleman told me at one of the major stores that over this past Christmas season, they brought in retired workers from the store, people who had worked at the store 5, 6, and 7 years ago, retired, and brought them in because they couldn't find regular employees to take the jobs, and they guaranteed them that it would only be handled, they would only be in there for that 7-week period. And that, so they said, okay, Now, the question that was said to me, what does that do to a retired person's Social Security? They get the Social Security, but when they make that 7 weeks, and now they're asking those same retired people, many of them in their 70s and all, to come back again for the spring and summer season because they simply can't get people. So they would get, their Social Security wouldn't be touched. But would they then also have to be paying a bigger part, not just the regular taxes, a bigger part on their earnings, the part-time earnings that they get?
Well, certainly, whenever you go to work, all of the wages are subject to Social Security tax and subject to income tax. The real problem is that what we call the labor force participation rate, which is the percent of adults between 18 and 65, percent of adults who are either working or actively seeking a job. Those are the people in the labor force. That percentage of the as a percent of the total has been going down. So people are, from COVID, a lot of people stopped working, and many of them didn't come back. Part of the reason is there's government programs that allow them to not work anymore. For a while there, during COVID and right after the recovery, there was a moratorium on people being evicted from their apartments. So you see people staying in their apartment, you know, 1 or 2 years and never paying any rent, and they couldn't be evicted. Then finally, when they could be, there was such a backlog, they ended up staying there longer. So they didn't have any rent to pay. Secondly, a lot of them were recent college graduates or people that went to college and didn't finish but have school loans. Well, President Biden comes along and says, we're going to make it so, one, you don't have to pay the payments on the school loans for a long, I think it went almost 3 years. And then when you do finally have to pay them, we're going to try to forgive those for as many people as we can. And then they increase the amount of benefits, welfare and food stamps and things that people can get. And some people found, you know, I can survive without working. So as a result of that, I'm not going back to work. So what we need to do is get more people to go back to work who are physically and mentally able to work, get them to go back to work, and let the people who retired stay retired and enjoy their retirement years. So those people that retired never envisioned having to go back to work. We set up the retirement. We have Social Security. Inflation is mild. I should be able to carry myself. Suddenly now prices are nearly 20% on average, nearly 20% higher today than when President Biden took office. And retirees never planned for that. So now they have to go back to work. There's a labor shortage anyway. So the company said, look, we'd like to have you back. And then we end up with this situation.
You know, and I'm hearing it more and more, even through people that I know at our agency. People say, Michael, we could use people like for 3-4 weeks. If you know anybody over the spring season and all who can help us out, let me know and we'll be happy to bring them on to help us out, especially if they've done things, you know, working in some sort of selling flowers at a major place or whatever, where we need people desperately. You're absolutely right. And by the way, when COVID hit, many of the elderly that needed assistance coming to their homes depended on their children, and the government was supporting them to be able to be taking care of their parents because agencies were no longer able to send people because of the COVID restrictions. Many people now are staying home with parents and also with children. So that's taken a lot of people out of the workforce. In fact, in speaking with someone, they said the price of everything has gone up to the point that it's not going to be affordable. We're going to see poverty growing, Michael, like we've never seen it. Just to give you an idea, and I'm going to turn to Larkin to speak with you and also to Bruce. In the year 2014, that's 2014, that's only 10 years ago, $1 was equivalent to a dollar today in 2024. Your dollar has, you have to put out a dollar 31 to 35 cents more for the same product that you were able to purchase for $1 in 2014. Now, that's really killing the situation for what can you do in America? How can we bring in more industries, more workers, when people in foreign countries, their workers may make nothing more in the last 10 years because it's run by, you know, communist governments or whatever, and they are sending their products over here and they keep upping the price to us, the American consumer, and to us, the American corporations buying the products, but they're not giving anything to their workers. So they're making money while we pay more money, and our people are each day losing job skills in particular industries. It doesn't make sense. Now, one more thing I want to add. The dollar had an average rate of 2.74% per year between 2014 and 2024. That's an increase of 31% on the dollar. In many countries around the world, the increase has been 6%. So how can we allow this to continue? Our people in Congress, our president, our national leaders, and everything has to, on this level with inflation, that has to be guided by national leaders. It was President Biden who signed the energy situation, canceled the Keystone Pipeline, and caused us this terrible hell in this country with poverty growing and everybody else is going crazy, because how can you work for a dollar and have to pay out a dollar 31 cents to buy a product? You understand what I'm saying, Professor?
Yeah, and you simply can't do that. So this problem has got to get fixed. You know, I blame the Federal Reserve also for some of this. In early 2021, it was obvious we were going to have an inflation problem. Yet the Federal Reserve and Secretary of the Treasury, Janet Yellen, both said, Jerome Powell from the Federal Reserve, both said, don't worry about it. This is temporary. They called it transitory inflation. The Federal Reserve did nothing all through 2021, and they really didn't get serious until June of 2022. By that time, the annual inflation rate was up to 9.1%. So finally, they got serious. They had to get very aggressive and raise interest rates from near zero up to the current level of about 5.3%, at least for the federal funds rate. What they should have done in 2021 is gradually raise the interest rate. The inflation rate wouldn't have gotten as high as it did, and we wouldn't be in this problem we're in today.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately for every American, young, old, and in between, the major inflation in this country took place during the last 3 years. All the research shows that it took place after January 2021. And as most of us know, a president's signature to something this major should not be permitted. I mean, at a time of war or something, I could see it, that he has to do something unbelievable. But when there is something like the canceling the Keystone Pipeline and all, that should be his idea. Okay, send it to the House and Senate for their discussion and their approval before he signs anything. I don't like the way this whole system is going. It's hurting every American. It's hurting my family. It's hurting your family. It's hurting every listener's family to be going through this for no reason other than it's poor leadership in this great United States of America. With that, I want to turn to Larkin Conley. Larkin, help us greet our Professor Michael Bussler.
Well, good morning, Michael. I know Bruce is on. I wanted to, Dr. Bussler, welcome. you're you're a fresh. Yeah, it's you are a pragmatic, fresh voice that always seems to have answers instead of just enumerating problems. The only remark I can make about what you said is the fact that Joe Biden could eliminate all of this student debt is frightening. But I'll tell you what I would have done without question. I would have said, your loan is forgiven. Here's the value of your loan. We'll pay you $25,000 a year. Go work it off. This country could use a program like that. I can't think of what it was with Roosevelt. WPA.
It was like a workforce program.
Let's go to work. And pay us back. We'll forgive you the debt. I mean, I understand. And maybe it isn't 25. I don't know. But the fact is they just turn around and walk away.
Larkin, what popsicle stand am I working at for 25 grand a year?
Well, you're working on the infrastructure. You're not... you're absolutely not working in a commercial environment. You're pulling weeds, whatever. Whatever has to be done, whatever needs to be done to make this country a little bit better of a place. What's popsicle stand? I can always count on the wonderful producer, but Professor Busser, let me ask you a question. My problem with all of the things that we discuss, what's wrong with America? If you could fix it, what would you do first? And blah 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 blah. We've turned into a world economy. Is screwed up right now. The whole world. You can't find a solid economy anywhere right now. How do we continue to maintain our leadership in the world so that we can conquer all these economic problems?
Professor Busler.
So what we have to do is go back to the principles that made the country great. I believe I've said this on the show before, but recall that the U.S. went from the birth of a nation to the largest, most prosperous economy in the world in about 150 years. Other countries were hundreds, in some cases thousands of years older. How did that happen? I believe we followed four basic principles. One, we encouraged individual freedom. As long as you didn't infringe upon anybody else's rights, you can pretty much do what you wanted. Two, we encourage individual responsibility. As long as you were mentally and physically able to take care of yourself, everybody pretty much took care of themselves. I had family, of course, to help out, but you didn't rely on the government. Thirdly, we had low rates of taxation. So you knew when you earned something and put your efforts out, the rewards you got, you were able to keep almost all of it. That was a tremendous incentive. And fourthly, we had a very limited role for government. They provided leadership of the country, a legal system, defense of the country, et cetera. But in terms of business, they pretty much got out of the way. So individual freedom, individual responsibility, low rates of taxation, and a limited role for government. Now, fortunately, we had some energy, that resources were good, and we had private property that helped. But those four principles, take a look at what the Biden administration has done. It's exactly opposite to all four of those. He's limiting individual freedom. He wants to take over the education, wants to take over the health care, And when the government takes over, it limits your choices. And we've seen that when the Affordable Care Act was passed. A lot of people had to not go to the doctor they've been used to going to. So he discouraged individual freedom. Secondly, he essentially said, don't worry, you don't have to take care of yourself. The government will take care of you. Mm-hmm. So instead of individual responsibility, he had social responsibility. Thirdly, instead of low rates of taxation, he's looking for all the different ways he can raise taxes. And as you do that, it reduces people's incentive to produce more. And fourthly, instead of a limited role for government, he's got the government involved in everything. So how could we fix it and go back to where it was, go back to those four principles? The prior administration pretty much followed that. You know, they encouraged individual freedom. They stopped many of these social welfare programs, so people had to go out and earn their own money. Unfortunately, the economy was such that there was opportunity for everyone. And so before the pandemic, the unemployment rate had gotten down to 3.5%. The poverty rate had hit a 40-year low of 10%. So instead of giving things out, the last administration gave people the opportunity to earn their own money to buy their own things. It's good for the government. We don't have to pay for people's things. It's good for people individually because it gives them a feeling of self-esteem. So go back to the way we had it under the last administration. Remember when Biden came into office in January of 2021, the last inflation number of December of 2020, inflation on an annualized basis was 1.4%. Unemployment was 3.5%. The economy was poised, I think, for some real growth. You know, then the pandemic hit and we had to shut down. So the answer is go back to those principles that made us great, and the prior administration followed them.
Bruce, what do you have to say to our great professor?
Yes, good morning, Michael, and good morning to you, Professor. How are you today?
I'm doing very well.
I'm not an economist by any manner of means, but I think that what you said is obviously correct. The trouble is that human beings get in the way. I don't know whether in we send to Ukraine as part of the cost we need to not spend. It's 1933 all over again, sort of thing. I'm a child of the British National Health System, which not best health system in the world, but I don't think you'll get a single English or British person to do away with it. It's one of those things that they're pretty proud of that in Britain. I'm sure that that doesn't fit into all the economic
Professor, I have a question for you. Do you know what percentage of our annual economy is directed to foreign aid and things like that?
So it's a little hard to get the number because it's buried in the defense budget. I'd have to do a little research to find that out. It's hundreds of billions of dollars, though. I mean, it's certainly a large sum of money. You know, this is really a tough one. So the thought originally was that if the U.S. Helped support a lot of these countries, then they would favor a more democratic society. And the fear was if you let countries like Russia and China and Iran, if you let them provide aid where they can, then the countries are more likely to follow that non-democratic system. So that was the thought in the beginning. And now you're at the Ukraine war, and even though Ukraine's not part of NATO, the fear was that, look, if Russia overtakes Ukraine, they might keep going into NATO countries, in which case all of the NATO countries would have to respond. So the thought was that the U.S. will supply aid, and European countries have supplied aid also, to the Ukraine, who we thought didn't have a chance against the powerful Russian military, and yet they're so far holding them off to a standstill. So question is, what do we do now? Well, we've spent billions of dollars, as the European countries have. Do we continue to support Ukraine with more aid? It gets very costly. That should allow them to at least hold off Russia, if not completely winning this war. Or do we say, look, we've given you all the money we're going to give you, and if that happens, then Russia will take over Ukraine, and then the question is, what's going to happen going forward? So it's a dilemma that we have to deal with. The other thing that really concerns prudent members of Congress who just don't want to throw money away, Ukraine, while we support their fight against Russia, they have a society with a lot of corruption. So we're not sure that these billions, tens of billions, that we're sending over there is actually going to fight the war, or is some of it going to, through corruption, going to somebody's pocket. We're trying to get more accountability with that. So the administration, both Congress and the president, I think are in a very, very difficult position, and they're going to have to come up with some kind of a solution that I think will be official. Yeah, let me also say one thing. Remember when the U.S. retreated from Afghanistan and left the Bagram Air Base with $85 billion worth of military equipment? They just left it there. Mm-hmm. And the Taliban took it, and who knows what they did with it. Had they held on to the Bagram Air Base, all of that equipment could have been shipped to Iran, and we wouldn't have to pay all this money, number one. And number two, we have a problem in the Middle East. So we don't have an air base nearby. We have to send all of our aircraft carriers there. Had we kept the Bagram Air Base, we could have used that as a base, and it would have been much easier to defend things. So the foreign aid is a very tricky thing.
Absolutely right. You know, I believe this should be the policy of America, and it should be the policy of any country that gives money to anyone else. You want a receipt for what your money was able to accomplish. That's the bottom line. For every penny of it, you go to a store, you buy a product, you get a receipt, you know what you bought. We give money outside to any country. We've been giving foreign aid to countries for many, many years with helping them to be, you were right, to help them to think more in a democratic way. Maybe they'll do this and that, become more part of our American thinking. But it's I don't know of any place I can go on the internet right now and see where our aid to any country has been spent. How did we spend it? How did we permit it? They offer a dollar amount that they need for this and that. If you're filing for any type of grant, city, state, or federal grant, or corporate grant, or foundation grant, you have to give them a complete proposal of exactly where the dollars are going to go. I don't see that with a lot of the foreign aid, and a lot of people question me about that too. And I say, well, that is something that should be discussed. This is an election year, and you should be asking your local congressmen and those senators that are up for re-election to give a report. With the internet, everything is real easy. A snap of the finger, you put it up there. People are supposed to be doing that. And people ask me just 2 weeks ago, how does the city and the state and the federal government prepare their budget? Where exactly do they get the statistics? Where exactly are they saying the money will be spent? It's nice for the president to get up there and we're going to put this much money out for this or that. But where exactly is that money going? Maybe 20 years ago, you could have held back on, you know, giving that report. But today, the American public, the people who are paying the taxes, should know where their money is going. Is there such a system that you know of, Professor?
There's supposed to be some accountability with when the when our government gives federal aid. Now, a lot of it has none. It just says, essentially, the country says, look, we need aid. We need it for this, this, and this. They give them the aid. The accountability portion is relatively weak. So we're not quite sure where all this aid is going to. You also bring up a larger problem. So when the government decides how much they're going to spend, where do they get these figures? So what they do is they take a look at how much in most budget items. They take a look at how much they spent next year, last year rather, what they need to add to it, and that becomes the budget for next year. So if we spent $1 million on something, they say, look, we have inflation, a few other things, we're going to have to increase it by 5% up to $1.05 million. And that's how they prepare the budget. What they should do is a technique we call zero-based budgeting. Instead of just saying it's a little more than last year, go back to the very beginning at ground zero and justify all the money that you've been spending. I think if we do that, that would significantly reduce government spending. Ironically, Jimmy Carter, who was not my favorite president, but he was a business person, and when he came into office, he said, maybe we should consider this zero-based budgeting. That's what I do in my business. Congress wouldn't hear any, even though it was a Democratic Congress, they wouldn't hear anything of it and haven't heard anything about it since. But that zero-based budgeting would be a way to help get spending down.
Let me ask you, Professor, is it even possible for America's federal budget to be dollar in, dollar out, balanced budget?
Is it possible? Yes. However, to get to that point, there would have, I mean, look, the budget, the deficit this year probably going to be in the $2 trillion range. You know, roughly they're going to spend almost $7 trillion and only bring in about $5 trillion in taxes. So can you balance the budget? The answer is yes, but you're cutting $2 trillion out of the seven. It's very difficult to do because the opposing party stands up and says, well, look, they want to throw a granny off the cliff. They're not going to give health care to anybody. They're reducing child care credits for people. And politically, it's a very difficult thing to do. But the answer is, yes, it could be done. Somebody is going to stand up at some point and say, we have to do it.
You know, Professor, according to what I know, and especially in the areas that I deal with, every state and city has to have a balanced budget. Why not the American budget, especially in items that we know really could be balanced? There are some situations, emergency type situations, that you can understand. But if it's for schooling, it's for roads, it's for security, whatever, that should be able to be balanced. And you know what I see happening is that the government takes, robs Peter to pay Paul, take one from this account to that account. So no one these days is able to even know how things are done. Miss Yellen was asked that question. She, you know, almost pretended she didn't hear the question. And, you know, nobody wants to own up to what the country's doing with the tax collections that it has. How can the president say, I'm going to forgive this, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that? It should be changed, if it has to be changed in the Constitution, that we want a balanced budget, number one. Number two, it should be changed in the Constitution that the president, unless it's a situation of war or something, that everything that he proposes must go through the House and Senate for an approval. If it did that when he signed in that energy bill in January of 2021, we would not be experiencing the unbelievable inflation that we've experienced in the last 3 years. It's almost insane. People,
Michael,
are
you're exactly right. Can we balance the budget? The answer is yes. You can balance the budget, and what you suggested, if the president or Congress wants to spend money on something, you should tell us where you're raising the money to spend. So if we did that, that would help to have a balanced budget, too. You know, the last time we had a surplus in the budget, not only balance, a slight surplus, plus was Bill Clinton's second term from 97 to 2000. How did that happen? First of all, he cut the capital gains tax from 28% to 20%, created so much more economic activity, the revenue from capital gains taxes went up, even though the tax rate went down. Also, it stimulated growth in the economy. For each of those last 4 years, growth averaged 4% per year. We haven't seen that since. Bill Clinton also said in his 1996 State of the Union speech, he said, the era of big government is over. And he worked with Newt Gingrich, who was made Speaker of the House, saying we're going to reduce spending, to reduce government spending. So he held the line on government spending, and he increased tax revenue, not by raising rates, but actually by lowering rates. He increased tax revenue. We had a surplus in the budget for each of those 4 years. I suggested Joe Biden do the same thing, lower the capital gains tax rate from 28, it's not 28 anymore, it's either 20 or 24, lower the capital gains rate, I think it should lower it to 15%, lower the capital gains rate, hold the line on government spending, declare the era of big government over, now it's exactly opposite to what Biden wants to do. He wants more big government, and that's why we're running into the problems that we have today.
You know, Professor, I just want to mention for Larkin and Bruce and everybody listening, right now, today, I am looking at the United States debt clock. What really concerns me is this. In the year 2000, that's 24 years ago, we had 161 million people working in the workforce. This year, we have 161,241,000 people working in the workforce. That's 24 years, and there's no increase in workers. Now, for the record, we have right now people in the workforce, 161 million people in the workforce. That's full-time and part-time. And we have 23 million government workers, almost 24 million government workers. That has increased in the last few years, and they're doing all sorts of special projects, road work, and things like that. But we have been taking people from the manufacturing end of it, from the business portion, and putting it into government workers. So it looks good, but it's not good for the long-term stability of the American people to have industries and regular sales jobs and things like that. More government workers does not mean a better economy for America. It's taking money from the economy to pay the government workers. How do you see that?
That's exactly right. And you know that the government workers, with all due respect, the government workers are not very efficient. And the reason is, the government workers are not motivated by profit. Not exactly sure what they're motivated by, but they're not motivated by profit. If you're in industry, you're motivated by profit. That means you want to try to produce things at the lowest possible cost, produce as efficiently as possible. And if there's ways you can figure out to get the cost down to produce a product in business, the workers and the management and everybody will try to do that. In the government, if they spend more money, that's okay. It's just more government spending. So when you have a larger portion of the workforce being government employees who are relatively inefficient, again, with all due respect, I don't want to criticize anybody, but relatively inefficient, it slows down economic growth and it tends to increase that inflation problem. We have way too many government workers, and as you correctly point out, a big segment of them were brought on by the Biden administration. You look at the job reports every month, you say, well, jobs went up, and look how much big of a chunk of that increase was due to increases in government workers. That's counterproductive to what we should be doing.
And next, you're exactly right. By the way, Professor, I want you to know I did some research on this, and this is very interesting. Every month they advertise we brought in another 250,000 jobs or 300,000 jobs. But what they don't tell you is that 190,000 of those jobs are people who retired from the workforce, were ill and were forced retired or left the earth forever and ever. Amen. They're not telling you the facts. It sounds good. But when you look at the U.S. debt clock, which is actually done by the Census Bureau and the Labor Bureau of the United States of America, in 24 years, we haven't gained any jobs, period. In 24 years. I don't understand how these lies are able to be continued and how the press does not take a look at the labor and industry clock or the United States. I mean, we're now in such trillions in debt. There's no way anybody will be able to repay that back. And it's just going up and up and up and up. And a president is supposed to be the main cheerleader here of the United States of America. I don't see any cheerleading going on. And I'm really disappointed to see the people in the Congress, and the whole Congress is up for re-election this November. I think the people listening should contact family, friends, and neighbors and say, see who's running. Make sure you get out to the primaries. Make sure you get out to the major election. And make sure you get out to some of the campaign places to talk to these people seeking to be your representative. Professor, I have to tell you this too, and Larkin and Bruce and also Henry and everybody listening, you're going to like this. Some particular person in government came and told me this. They said, Michael, this is owned by so-and-so, not by the people. This is owned by the government, not by the people. I said, well, wait a minute. The people pay the taxes. The taxpayers own everything, not the government. The taxpayers own everything. The taxpayers have to be speaking up. They haven't been speaking up because they fear that government's going to have some kind of a way to get back at them. I tell government officials what's on my mind, whether they like it or not. But the thing is, we own everything in the United States, from the Capitol to Independence Hall, whatever it is, we own it. We paid for it. Not any individual elected in the House or Senate or the President of the United States. We, the taxpayers, and I urge them to start speaking up, to go out of their way to fight back against this unbelievable inflation. And don't buy foreign stuff. Have inflation stopped with your wallet. If it's not made in America, it's not supporting American workers, don't buy it for now. And let's get the word out to the industries in America that are making things that we appreciate you. We want you to grow. We want our people employed. But there's so many people that don't want to speak up. They keep calling me on various programs to talk, you know, talk my mind. But the thing is, the people, Professor, you are an unbelievable speaker. You're very much appreciated by our listeners, and they don't only listen on the 11 to 12 o'clock time. They listen on the internet. It's broadcast here and there. It's listed in newspapers to tune in to rebroadcast. People are starting to get together and talk more about kitchen table issues. And the reason for it is they're now being slaughtered. They're being slaughtered with inflation. Some people tell me, Michael, I thought my 401k and my savings would, you know, take me through life, but it's being eaten and eaten away by inflation. What do you have to add to that?
So I'll tell you, Michael, he made a couple of good points. Let me start off with number one. The federal government, as you correctly pointed out, doesn't have any money. All they have is what they take from taxpayers. So when you say, I want the government to pay for this, I want the government to do that, you're saying you want somebody else to pay for something for you. So it's the taxpayers that pay for everything here. You're right. It's not owned by the government. It's owned by the American people who paid for it. Secondly, let me comment on the debt. So the total public debt is now up to $34.5 trillion. You say, well, is that a lot of money? Obviously it is. Most economists will say if the public debt stays less than 1 year's GDP, you're probably okay. Above that, it's a problem. GDP is about $25 trillion. The public debt's $34.5 trillion, way above. So the next question people say to me, well, what exactly is the problem? Well, two problems with that. One, the interest on the public debt this year will be about $650 billion. As we incur more debt, and there's no program in place to ever pay this debt back. Let me say that again. There's no program in place to ever pay this debt back. So what do? You run a deficit, you sell a 10 or 20-year bond. What happens when it comes due? Well, you sell a new bond to pay back the old bond, and you roll over the debt. So the debt never goes down unless you run a surplus in the budget. The debt is never going to go down. And when we refinance some of the debt that was taken out at 1.5%, the Treasury rate now is 4.5%. So you've just tripled the interest payment without even incurring any more debt. So the total interest payment this year is $660 billion. Before the end of the decade, it will go up to $1 trillion in interest paid every year. And that's $1 trillion you can't use for better things, more productive things. We've got to get a handle on this. The way to do it is to attempt at least to try to balance the budget as soon as possible and try to get these future deficits down. You know, then we'll have to work on something to pay back the public debt.
You know, you're right. I tell you, everywhere I go, people tell me something. It gives me more and more ideas. The people are very angry because the people are being employed by government instead of being employed by businesses. Businesses need a lot of those skilled workers. They're being pulled into government to do road work and all this other stuff. They need workers graduating from America's high schools with some level of skills. Something has to be done within the educational system. And people say, Michael, don't ever get off that subject because people are going into their various school board meetings and speaking about, you know, what has to be done to change things in particular areas. If you need skilled workers in the heating and air conditioning and building industry and all, you need those people already with some idea coming out of high school. You don't want somebody to come in and just say, oh, for a month after a month, that's much harder than I thought it was going to be. We need people in those kinds of jobs, but we also need people in Congress, people who are really concerned about our future, not just to sit there and be prima donnas to, you know, to do nothing, just to collect the money, get the per diem money for being a congressperson or a senator or whatever. They're doing no justice to America, and yet the press and the American people are not speaking up about it. I don't understand how this is going to change.
Well, the way you have to change it is to get a new administration in the White House and a new majority in both houses of Congress and elect people, as you say, elect people who share America's values instead of electing people who think they know what's best for America. You know, the thing is, when people are working in business, business makes a profit generally by giving the consumers exactly what they want at exactly the price they're willing to pay for it. Mm-hmm. That's how business works. Government gives people what they think they should have, and they'll influence the price for the product, and it's extremely inefficient. We need more people back in business, and we need to let business take the regulations off of business. Look, we don't want to harm anything. We understand that. We all live here. But let business do what they do, and that is to figure out what consumers want, and then figure out how to profitably get it to them at exactly the price they're willing to pay.
Yes. And I'd love to see more of our businesses get together and have these types of conferences. You know, with computerization and Zooming and all, there's no reason for these business leaders to be up talking about what they need, what kind of employees they need. If we can't get it through the elected people, let's start getting the business people involved to speak up for the well-being of our future here in America. Professor, I have a final question to ask you. Do you see any of the schools where you are promoting the trades and technology classes?
The science and technology, what they call the STEM classes, are being promoted and increased. So science, technology, computer systems, chemistry, biology, all those kind of things, they are increasing, mostly because there's a demand from students, because students realize, hey, if I learn all this and go out in the workforce, I can get a good job at a good income. There still is a large segment of even my university and other schools where they're pushing education in areas where it may not be beneficial to students once they graduate in terms of providing a living for themselves and contributing to society. The liberal causes are still dominant in a lot of schools.
Yes. I want to say, first of all, I want to say thank you to Larkin Conley, to Bruce Bassett Powell, our engineer, Henry Chaplinsky, and thanks also to Professor Michael Bussler. You were absolutely fantastic, and I'm going to ask people, if they have questions for the professor, the next time you come on, I will reserve them for you to send them to michael@americanworkersradio.com. Professor, thank you so much for taking the time from your schedule to be with us today. We appreciate all that you do. And in behalf of Larkin Conley, Mark Andel, Bruce Bassett Powell, Henry Chaplinsky, and all of our listeners, I want to wish you and yours a very enjoyable spring, and we look to have you with us again in the very near future. And ladies and gentlemen, until we get together again this Saturday at 11 or next Wednesday at 11, I want to wish all of you a very enjoyable holiday. Stay well, be happy, God bless, seek out American-made products, and speak up where you shop. Have a great one.